And it's great to see y'all this morning. It's always good to be together with you. Sundays is especially one of my favorite days. I think we should sing more and talk less. That is just it's such a blessing here, such a blessing. Oh, yeah. Listen, I got no qualms with that. At all. It's great to be a part of a congregation that loves to worship and does so in such a powerful way. And I know, at least now, in part, how that happens, because last night I went to Joe and Julia's house and I saw all the great singers we have in karaoke. Now, if you have never experienced karaoke, this is a great way to do it. You don't have to go to a bar to do this. Everybody was sober to the best of my knowledge last night. And they sang and sang songs that I knew. Some I knew, some I didn't know. I sang songs I didn't know. Apparently, I thought I knew them until we got up there. I'm going to have to really work on my Kenny Rogers. Apparently, I just not the silver fox I thought I was. So, yeah, but it was so good. It was it's just great to be a part of a fellowship of people who love to be together like that. It's always a blessing to be a part of God's church wherever we may be, but I cannot reiterate enough how thankful we are to be a part of Forest Mill and this great, great church that the influence you have on the community. One other thing about one day, I guess we're calling it one day of soap. We're trying to get these 9,000 bars of soap, and if you want to go out and buy bars of soap, God bless you. But if you would like to give money, we have got a deal set up where those who are working with this can get far more soap for the buck than you can get for the buck. So if you would just like to donate money, that would be, a dollar will get about 3 bars of soap with the deal they've got set up. So if you find it cheaper than that, go get it. But otherwise, if you can just donate money, that would be really, really good. So I really encourage you to do that. I have yet to be a part of One Day of Hope. I'm looking forward to it, and I'm looking forward to seeing the way Forest Mill is able to reach out into our community and continue to bless them. It was a defining moment in my life. It was December of 2002, and perhaps the most jubilant moment of my entire life. After a long and difficult pregnancy, my wife had finally given birth to this beautiful, healthy, enormous baby boy. He weighed almost 10 pounds. And I had just become a father. So I was just elated. And one of my closest friends, after the birth, and it was going to be some time before we could kind of be with the baby and be with Rebecca because of her surgery. And so he decided to take me out to lunch to celebrate. So we went out and we kind of celebrated the joyous occasion. But when I returned to my wife's hospital room, she, along with some of our other close friends who were in there with her, were wondering why they hadn't brought this handsome baby into the hospital room. And within a few minutes of my arrival, the doctor came in and finally began talking to us. He summoned me out into the hallway. I remember that. And over the course of the next few minutes, he proceeded to tell me how our big, healthy son was experiencing seizures of a kind and severity that this hospital in West Kentucky was ill-equipped to handle, that our son was going to have to be life-flighted from there to a specialized children's hospital in Louisville. I, bearing the full weight of this news, remember walking back into the hospital room. But I couldn't tell you what I said or what I did or what went on in that room. Less for privacy reasons, more because I was just numb. I couldn't even process what was going on. And so I remember getting in the car with my mother-in-law because Rebecca couldn't leave the hospital yet. My mother-in-law and I would go up to meet the helicopter in Louisville. And that drive to Louisville was just a blur. I couldn't tell you anything about that drive. I remember getting to Sarah's Children's Hospital and waiting in that NICU area, family room, forever. I mean, it was just interminable. And we're watching all of these other parents who have sick babies in there and the drama that goes on with that. It was just so tense. And it's about that time I began pacing the floors of the hospital. Now, I believe that God has the power. I believe that God can accomplish the healing. I believe that miracles are possible and that they still happen. So I got down on my knees and I begged God for a miracle, son. I made every bargain I could make with God. And by the time he arrived at the hospital where we were, my mother-in-law and I were just this bundle of anxiety and nerve and fear. We were in the best children's hospital in the entire state, one of the best children's hospitals in the country. But even after medication and even after all of that, the seizures continued, unabated. Have you ever been at that point, that situation in life, where you've asked God for something, for a miracle? And you said, God, you can make all things new. I said, God, you can make my son completely well. You can heal him completely. You could even make it so that he never has another episode like this in his entire life, if that's what you choose to do. And so Lord, I said, Lord, I'm asking you for a miracle, but it didn't happen. My son having seizures. Have you ever been there? Have you ever wrestled with that? It can lead you to some conclusions about God. You can lead you to think maybe God's not capable of handling it. Maybe God doesn't care that it's happening. Maybe God's not even there. How do we handle it when the prayers that we desperately pray, the miracle we desperately seek and want, when that fails to happen the way we expect it to happen, the way we want it to happen? Well, as we continue our study through the Gospel of John, that we're calling Jesus a biography, because we're trying to learn who Jesus is, it's important for us that we learn whether or not this Jesus is worth asking for a miracle, right? Whether he is the Jesus that he claims to be in Scripture. And if that's where you are this morning, or if that's somewhere you've been, we need to deal with that. And Scripture does a great job of that. So we're going to be focusing this morning on a passage taken from John chapter 2. If you have your Bibles, you want to open up to John chapter 2. Today's passage is about a wedding. So in order to understand this story, we've got to get a little bit of background about first century Jewish wedding. I've never been to a first century Jewish wedding. I've never even been to a Jewish wedding. So I had to do a little bit of research here. Marriage in Jesus' day had this period called a betrothal, or we would think of it like an engagement sort of, that was up to a year before actual marriage celebration. And the man and the woman would enter into a binding agreement to get married. And in Jesus' day, the man at that period, when he asked for this woman's hand in marriage, would give the father of the bride a marriage gift, a sort of a pledge, a form of compensation to the father. Some of that he gives the father would actually come back to the couple in the form of a dowry. The father, when the marriage actually takes place, he would give the young couple some sort of financial package. And it could be in the form of cattle, it could be in the form of a place to live or land, or it could be in the form of money. But he would give that to the couple to ensure that they would have this financial stability as they were starting off their lives, which is a great practice for parents to do until my kids get married. Right? I mean, to start off with just this small boon, this little bit of stability. So during this betrothal period, the couple doesn't live together, the marriage is not consummated, but they're still considered husband and wife, and it's so binding, an agreement, that it couldn't be dissolved without a formal legal divorce. They were considered married in the eyes of the law. And once it is over, the marriage is celebrated, and the groom and his friend go over to the bride's house, and they get the bride, they escort her in her beautiful dress, and they escort her over to the groom's home, where there's this festive kind of procession, and there's where the procession takes place at the home of the groom. And there was probably some sort of exchange of vows, some sort of religious ceremony. At least that's what we think. We don't know for certain, but we believe that takes place by this period in Jewish history. And the groom and it gives his bride these gifts to tell her, one, how much he loves her. You know, we kind of do that in the form of rings, although but he also does it to sort of show that he's able to take care of her. So to show her that what guy worth marrying, that I can take care of you, I can provide for you, I can be a good provider. And so the bigger and the more the gifts that he gives, the bigger and the larger the festivities that goes on, it's demonstrating his ability to be a good husband. So that's a big deal in their culture. It's important that we realize that these festivities would go on sometimes for a week or even more. It's in that setting, in the midst of this wedding celebration, that our case in the text takes place. So beginning at 1 of John 2, we read, "On the third day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee." Just pause real quick. Cana was about 8 miles from Nazareth, where Jesus grew up. These are likely friends, close friends of his family, somebody he knew and had grown up with. So he goes with his disciples. It says the third day, this is the third day, referencing back to the previous chapter, the third day since he called Philip. They passed a Sabbath day in the meantime. We don't have any information about that Sabbath day. But the third day after he calls Philip, they're at this wedding in Cana. So Jesus' mother was there. Jesus had and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine was gone, and we can talk about that in a minute, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." Just pause right there, because we need to talk about this. Need to explain, because we might or might not appreciate the problem of this passage. In our culture, we run out of something, anything, we can run to the store and get it, really, time of the day or not. Even if we run out of wine, now you could go to Walmart 24 hours, right? Or you could go to a 24-hour liquor store, I hear. Though none of you ever wave at me when you see me in there, I don't know what the deal is. Maybe I shouldn't be standing in there with, I don't know, I'm just kidding. But in Jesus' culture, there's no 24-hour stores to go to, right? There's no way, and this is people over a long period of time, there's no way, they can get some wine, but there's no way to get enough wine in enough time. This is a way bigger issue. I mean, so it would have been a huge embarrassment to the groom, who now looks like he doesn't have the ability to actually care for his wife. It would have been shame on him and his family. Because this is the time the groom is supposed to be really putting on a show, demonstrating his ability to care for his wife. So for the people in this story, this was not a case of, this is not just a problem like some weddings might run into, just not enough booze. You know, a lot of weddings have served a lot of alcohol, and there are some times that may even run out. But that's not what's gone here. This is not just, there's not enough booze. This is not a problem of just not enough to drink or enough wine. So Mary, the mother of Jesus, intervenes, and she seems to be in a situation. They're probably so close to this family that she is helping the wedding. That's how come she's able to intervene. She knows about it before the rest of the guests do. She's maybe preparing the dishes. She's maybe helping in some sort of status like that. So she's involved in the wedding celebration. She goes to Jesus, and she tells him about the problem before it kind of becomes knowledge, and hoping that he'll be able to provide a solution. And Mary has that that my wife has. Guys, I think it's a gift of women. Maybe your mother or your wife has this ability too. She asks for help without directly asking for help. She says, "Jesus, there's no more wine." Did you notice that? She doesn't ask him anything. Just an open indictment. Trash carrying out. Yard looks like it needs cutting. You know? And so then she looks at her son. She sort of waits for an answer. I like to imagine, because I have to use my imagination here, I like to imagine there was a second or two pause of silence as Jesus sort of processes this. And he's like, "Oh, my mother is asking me to do something about this wine, right? Hoping he will respond. And so this is what he says. He says, "Woman, why do you involve me?" We'll talk about that too. Jesus replied. He says, "My hour has not yet come." And this verse is packed full of questions. It's a short verse. We're just going to read this and stop for a sec. First, what sort of tone did Jesus use when he says, "Woman"? I mean, is Jesus going Archie Bunker on us here? Where, oh, man, for everybody who's under 50, maybe. No, was he saying, "Woman, you know, why are you getting me into this? I don't know about that." The second is, okay, Greek word here that's used for woman, any disrespect. This was not a disrespectful tone. It's curious why he did not call her mom or mother, but he uses a term that's still respectful in calling his mother woman. Translations even do this. They'll say dear woman, which is probably a better way of us understanding it. The word dear is not in the Greek. I don't mean to use that. But the way he used woman, the way we use woman, two different things. So you gotta make a little bit of a cushion there so we can understand it. So he's just calling her dear woman, right? The second question comes from this use of the phrase, "hour has not yet come." Or your translation may say, "not yet come." Literally, it's hour. Well, what does that mean? Because I think that this is the key phrase to understanding this passage. Is understanding my hour has not yet come. There are those who say, means by this, that he's not ready to begin his public ministry. That he's not ready to step out into the spotlight and start doing these public. And this, the author tells us, John tells us, that this was Jesus' first public miracle. In fact, this is the beginning of a section of John that's called the Book of Signs by a lot of people, because there's linked together these seven miraculous events that are all strung together to sort of engender belief in the reader. Like, you're reading about Jesus. Am I going to follow this Jesus? Am I going to believe in this Jesus? Is this really the Jesus, really the Son of God? And so John gives us a string of seven miracles and other acts that are supposed to us to look at that and say, that's a guy I want to follow. So maybe it's just that Jesus wasn't ready to start that yet, you know, but I don't think that's actually true. Some people have put that forward, and a lot of people have taught that, but I don't personally think that's true. The author tells us that this is his first miracle, but I don't think my hour kind of adequately sums up what he means there by first miracle. Jesus uses the phrase "my hour" or "my time" five times in the Gospels. If you go through Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, he uses that phrase five times. And every time he uses that, it's to refer to his death on the cross and his resurrection. Every time. There are no exceptions. So, considering that in the light of this passage, the wine has run out, and Mary seeks Jesus to intervene, and Jesus says, "You know, woman, why are you getting me involved? My hour has not yet come." I don't think we can just narrow that down to he's not ready to start his public ministry. I think instead it's a pointed statement about Jesus' real purpose in coming. It indicates that even at this point, even before Jesus begins his public ministry, so to speak, although he's already got disciples following him, that even before he kind of is publicly known, before his first public miracle, that his ultimate purpose was not in doing those things. His ultimate purpose was coming to die on the cross and be resurrected from the grave to fulfill those prophecies. So we need to keep that in mind as we kind of continue through this story, that Jesus' ultimate purpose was not to do miracles. That's not what Jesus came to do. That was a means to an end. His purpose was to create faith in his followers so that they might follow him in his ministry. His purpose was to save man from their sins. His purpose was not to do miracles. If Jesus' purpose was to do miracles, he failed. Every one of the people Jesus healed still died. They died of diseases, they died of old age, they died of accidents, they died. In fact, they became sick after they were healed. So if Jesus' sole purpose was to do miracles, he was a failure. The miracles were just a means to an end. His purpose, his hour, was about dying on the cross for the sins of mankind and being resurrected from the grave. So Mary hears Jesus' statement, and she responds in verse 5. She says, His mother said to the servants, do whatever he tells you. In light of what we've just learned here, we can see that Mary is baiting her son into doing a miracle, even though he doesn't want to do a miracle. He wasn't telling her, I'm not going to do a miracle. He was just saying, this is not what I'm here for. My purpose here is not just, look, party's going bad, I need to fit. You know, that's not my real purpose. That's not saying he's not going to do it, but that's not what he's there for. And so she just says, instead, she just comes to Jesus in faith and submission. And she says, you know, whatever you want. She humbly defers to the authority of Jesus. And she looks to the servants. She says, do whatever he says. This is Mary's way of just saying, I give up control of the situation. If he does something, he does something. If he doesn't, he doesn't. But he's in control now, not me. You do whatever he tells you. And so, continuing through the rest of the text here. Nearby stood six stone jars, the kinds used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. By the way, John is writing to Jewish people. Why would he tell them the kind of jars that Jews use? Because he's writing to Jewish people who are not from Palestine. Even the Jewish practices are different throughout the regions of the Roman Empire. And he's explaining to them, you know, here, Jews use these big stone jars, and they're filled with water, and you use them for ritual washing, probably for utensils and other things as well, a ceremonial cleansing, not like your dishes after supper, but a way to sort of purify from sin or contamination the utensil eating. So these were standing there, and Jesus said to the servants, fill the jars with water. Let's do a little math here. Each one of these jars would hold, let's say 25 gallons. That's right in the middle. 25 gallons, there's six of them, that's 300 gallons. That's a lot of gallons, right? 300 gallons of water, and they filled them to the brim. They would have been somewhere near the well there. And then he told them, now draw some, take it to the master of the banquet. So the servants, they're like, why am I taking water to the master of the banquet? And they did so, and the master of the banquet tasted the wine, tasted the water that had been turned into wine, and he didn't realize where it had come from, even though the servant water knew. The servants are just standing there like, here's some water. And he drinks it and says, no, this is wine. And then he called the bridegroom aside and said, everyone brings out the choice wine first and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink. But you have saved the best till now. You've saved the best till now. In this passage, there is this unaccounted transformation that takes place. There's nothing added to the water, Kool-Aid. They just stir in some extra grape juice, powdered grape juice. The water is just transformed into wine. Whatever Jesus said or did caused the atoms and the molecules to rearrange in such a way that is unexplainable. This is absolutely a miracle. It's sleight of hand. It's not a trick. He didn't swap out these water jars while people weren't looking. This is an unexplainable miracle. And we see that this new wine is really good. And when it's brought to the headmaster, that's exactly what he says. He's like, this is the good stuff. I mean, usually you serve the best stuff first, and that was good, but this is way better than your best stuff. This is the best stuff. Now, I have to stop here and identify a potential question / ethical conflict of sorts. There are people who read this passage and see it as a justification for drinking and partying. And their logic goes something like this. When the alcohol ran out at the wedding Jesus was at, he didn't go buy a new keg, he did a new keg. Right? We know who knows who a keg is. Now what a keg is. Now. And if Jesus created alcohol from water to party, then he must be okay with partying in general. And that term partying, by the way, almost always means consuming excess alcohol. So people will use this passage to justify saying it's okay for me to drink excess alcohol. Jesus made 300 gallons of the stuff. And if you use this passage to justify partying, and that's the point you're getting from it, you are missing out on it entirely. You're missing the deeper, richer picture that this passage develops. You know why he just water into wine? It was not just so this guy would have a successful wedding, though I think that was a benefit. It was not just so that people would think, oh, this is a good party, though I think that was an effect. It was so, verse 11 tells us, so that he could reveal his glory to his disciples and that they would have faith to follow him. That's what this miracle was for. The reason Jesus made this was so that people believe in him and follow him. This wedding miracle, Jesus' first public miracle in the book of John, what does this mean for us? Well, first and foremost, I think it means that the miracle we seek is not always the best miracle. Let me explain. Mary was looking for a miracle, lowercase m, when she comes to Jesus with the problem of the family running out of wine. You don't want to do that. She's looking for a miracle, lowercase m, when she comes to this family, right? She sees her son as the answer to this immediate pressing need, much the way we do sometimes. I'm sick. This is the need. I'm out of money. This is the immediate pressing need. Somebody I know is sick or dying or having problems with their marriage or their kids. This is an immediate pressing need. Jesus fixed the immediate pressing need. And Jesus says, that's not my purpose. My hour is different. I came to do miracle. A miracle, capital M, not a lowercase m, a big M miracle. Jesus' role is not to solve every dilemma that we have in this life. I want him to. It's not, by the way, it's not wrong to ask for that. And sometimes he does solve those dilemmas. Absolutely he does. Jesus does heal people who are sick. Jesus does help people who are having struggles with their marriages and their kids and their finances. Absolutely God intervenes in those situations. I'm not saying that God is not capable or doesn't do those, because it's true, he does. I have seen them. I have experienced them. And I believe God's action in today's world is essential for a believing Christian to have in their understanding. That if your God you're following doesn't do anything now, he's not alive. So God has to be alive. And there's nothing wrong with asking for the lowercase m miracle. But Jesus says, that's not my purpose. My purpose is that you'll have faith in me and follow me when I die on the cross for your sins and I'm resurrected from the grave. That's what I'm really here for. And I think sometimes we pray that our greatest hope is that we'll see a lowercase, a little m miracle. But that wasn't Jesus' primary purpose. We should see the cross and the empty grave and know that God has provided a big M miracle to get us. Now, I continue to pray that my son's seizures will never return. And they haven't since he was a few months old. And to me, that's a miracle. That's a small M miracle. It's not my capital M miracle, because no matter how much I pray, my son is still going to die one day. And I'm still going to die one day. We're all going to get sick. We're going to get injured. And the little M miracles never last. But even if I don't see, or I didn't see, or I never saw a little M miracle, I know that my request for the big M miracle stands strong. So despite things like cancer and dementia, despite things like strokes and arthritis, God has given a new life, a new creation through the cross. That we have new life because the tomb was empty. And that's what we need to do. That's the focus of our faith. If the focus of our faith is God to do everything, every little thing we want him to do, every time something comes up and we have an urgency pressing need. You know what we call those people in our society? We call them takers. Hey, I've got this problem. You take care of it. Hey, I've got this problem. You take care of it. My family doesn't have enough money. You take care of it. My kids need a ride to school. You take care of it. And you're like, wait a minute. Why can't you do some of this? Right? So why would we think we should treat our relationship with God that way? When we come before Jesus with a request for miracles, we as followers should always keep in mind the capital M perspective on Jesus' ministry, that that's what he's here for. And I'm not saying that little M requests for long are wrong. It's that when we genuinely seek to discover him, we're going to find the big M miracle. That's the one that's always revealed. But secondly, I want you to know, and lastly, I want you to know, that Jesus doesn't play hide and seek with those who seek to discover him. When we read this chapter in the previous chapter, it seems that John's giving an illustration of what he said back in chapter 1. We read this. We have seen his glory, the glory of the only sent from God, full of grace and truth. That this was the first case of Jesus revealing his glory to disciples. So if you are out here this morning in our worship time and you don't know Jesus, but you genuinely seek him, I don't want you to think you've got to be a really good finder to get him. Kids have learned to play hide and seek in our house. It has got all these nooks and crannies and hidden compartments and closets. And I mean, kids think it's like Hogwarts. This old house has got all these great places to hide. And they were playing hide and seek the other day with my niece and my nephew. And my son was hiding and they could never find him. The kids were getting so mad. And because it's not that big a space, it's not like we live in a grand mansion. How come we can't find him? They would go and they would look and they just wouldn't see him. They were like, "You've got to come help us find him. We cannot find him." Jesus is not a great hider. He's not like waiting over there under the bed or in the dark corner of the closet. And you've got to just be really good to see him. Jesus wants to be found. He wants you to come to him and believe his claims about who he is. And if you will investigate him, he will reveal himself to you. Readily and willingly, that's what he wants. And this morning, maybe you're a Christian already. Most of us this morning here are. And we feel like maybe Jesus is hiding from us sometimes. And sometimes it's because we're not looking very good. And sometimes it's because we're just not paying attention. But I want you to know Jesus wants to be found. And he will reveal himself to you. And if we can help you with that this morning, whether it's prayers for encouragement or forgiveness, whether you're ready to become a child of God and put on Jesus Christ in baptism, if you have any needs this morning, won't you come as we stand and as we sing?
My only hope is you, Jesus.